Welcome to Radio Aldi, brought to you by Bailey Gifford.
I'm Charlotte Metcalf, and today I am very excited to be in conversation with one of our most acclaimed and award-winning playwrights, screenwriters and translators, Christopher Hampton, knighted in 2020 for services to drama. It would not be an exaggeration to say he's a prodigy, because at just 20 he was the youngest playwright ever to have a play performed in the West End with When Did You Last See Your Mother, and in 1976 at just 30 he was made a Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature. He is perhaps best known for Dangerous Liaisons, which he adapted for the stage in 1985 from the 1782 French novel Les Liaisons Dangereuses, and his Oscar-winning screen adaptation of the same play that Stephen Frears directed in 1988. Dangerous Liaisons is now back at the National Theatre, and Christopher is also in rehearsal for his stage adaptation of his screenplay of Ian McEwan's Atonement, which will have its world premiere at Chichester Theatre on the 29th of May. And as if that wasn't enough, he's also in rehearsals for Florian Zeller's The Truth at the Apollo in the West End. Christopher Hampton, a very warm welcome to Radio Aldi. I'm amazed you've got the time to come and talk to us.
Thank you. Well, I've got a day off today. I've been commuting between my two rehearsal rooms, which are conveniently close to one another. But today they're busy doing other things, so I had the day off.
Well, it's completely our win. I'm absolutely thrilled, because your body of work is phenomenal. Can we start with Dangerous Liaisons at the National? Tell us all about it, and are you enjoying it?
Well, it has been very, it's been very enjoyable. When Marianne Elliott decided that she wanted to do it a couple of years ago now, she spoke to me about looking at it again and reconsidering it in the light of it being 40 years on from when I first did it. And so I hadn't, it had occurred to me before, but I sat and looked at it and thought about what I might do, and wound up, I think, improving the parts of two of the subsidiary female characters. It's kind of a particular pleasure to have a successful play revival, because you're not quite sure whether they'll stand the test of time.
I mean, Leslie Manville is utterly brilliant in everything, so for her to take the original Lindsay Duncan part, that's one thing.
She was in the original production.
Was she?
Stratford.
Lindsay
Duncan played the part that Leslie is playing now.
Ah.
And Leslie played the 16-year-old girl.
Oh, and what about Aidan Turner? Because Alan Rickman, with that great voice, is a tough act to follow.
Alan was Alan and will never be replaced. Was a great friend of mine, and I miss him a lot. But Aidan is playing it in a much more, he's not such a masterful figure. He's more in the thrall of of Madame de Merteuil, Leslie, and is actually a really accomplished actor, I think. He can do three things at once in a very impressive way.
What are the three things he can do at once?
He can be amusing, he can be sort of snide, and he can be slightly menacing.
And girls love him.
yes, well, they loved Alan as well. I remember he got a letter from somebody saying, as a lifelong feminist, could you please explain to me why I left the story of this appalling man half in love with him.
So tell us about Atonement.
Yes, well, Atonement, I've always liked Ian McEwan's books.
Mm.
And I was going out to the Far East to direct a film, which in fact never came, the money disappeared at the last minute. But I was going out to Thailand, so I picked it up to read on the plane and couldn't put it down. And when I came back from Thailand, I called up Jenny Casarotta, my agent, and said, I read this book and I think it would make a wonderful film. Can we make some inquiries? And she said, oh, listen, there's lots of people who want to do this. Join the queue. I think Ian, having decided not to write the script himself for reasons personal reasons, I suppose, he did retain the right to choose who was going to write it. So I had a sort of audition dinner with him and with Richard Eyre, who was going to direct it at the time.
But he didn't, did he?
He didn't, Richard, because he had another film simultaneously. And so Joe Wright did it. And I met Joe and he said, well, I like the script. The script's very good. But he said, I think we should start from scratch. Always the words that a screenwriter dreads to hear most. So we did. We really started again. And then he shot the result, which I think is a very fine film.
Yes. Yes. So who's playing in the Chichester version? And how did Chichester get their hands on it? It's a big coup for a local theatre.
When I was at school at Lancing College, sort of between Brighton and Worthing, and we used to have... It was the days of Laurence Olivier before the current National Theatre was built, his operation was at the Old Vic, and his out-of-town operation was Chichester. So, as a schoolboy, I got to see the famous, for example, Uncle Vanya with Michael Redgrave and Laurence Olivier's Astroff and Joan Plowright and Joan Greenwood. And I also saw plays with Maggie Smith and Albert Finney. And I love the theatre. I think it's great.
And who's in it?
The only person I'd previously heard of was Sean Phillips, who's playing the role that Vanessa Redgrave played in the film. But we have some really good young actors.
You mentioned arts in college. Can we go back a bit to your childhood? Because though you went to prep school in England and Lancing, you had an extraordinary upbringing.
Yeah, first place I remember is Aden, which is like the, face of the moon, only hot. It's a really ghastly place. I was about three when my father went there. My father worked for Cable and Wireless, which was a sort of old imperial company that was in charge of all the telecommunications in the world, or most of the world. And so it was like being in the army. You got posted from... He was a radio engineer, and you got posted from one place to another. And then when I was about five, we went to my father's favourite posting, where he'd started out in the 30s, which was Alexandria.
Oh, wonderful.
Which was the most fabulous cosmopolitan city at that point. It was an extraordinary place. I mean, when I was sort of seven or eight, the boys I was at school with could all speak four or five languages. I mean, they could all speak English and French and Italian and Greek and Arabic.
But you're a great linguist. How many languages do you speak?
Well, that's where it all comes from.
Is it? That's interesting.
So I had to at least get a bit of Arabic and French to sort of get by, really. And I was there until 1956, the Suez Crisis.
Did you not have to flee?
We did. My mother and my brother and I were on the last boat out before the invasion. We got a launch out to the boat and climbed up the side of this huge Australian liner with our bits of luggage. And my father was there all the way through. And then when I came back to England, I actually was put into a prep school, boarded. My mother had always promised I wouldn't have to go to boarding school, but anyway, I was put into a boarding school, and I began saying the things that my father had said to me, i.e. about the idiocy of the British invasion and the stupidity of the idiots who were running this country, and I got very promptly hauled up before the headmaster and told that our men were risking their lives out there and I was to keep my mouth shut. And my brother was at a different public school at that point, who had come back from Egypt with a sort of souvenir fez.
Yes.
The headmaster burned it in front of the whole school.
No. You were at school with David Hare, weren't you?
Yes, and Tim Rice.
Are you still friends with David Hare? Were you friends?
We all had lunch last week.
Did you? And was he writing already at school, or...?
I think he was. I mean, we were certainly doing a lot of acting, so that there was a lot of that was all very much encouraged. And I think after A-levels, we built an open-air theatre up above the school, which is still there. And we did a lot of plays. And at one point, if memory serves, we actually, two or three of us, including David and me, sat down to write a play together. But I decided quite soon, after a couple of days, I was not a collaborating type.
What was your first play that you wrote? It was because you got fantastic scholarship to Oxford and double starred first and all that. But meanwhile, we're writing plays and acting.
What actually happened was that I was I got into Oxford, and then I was looking forward to staying at Lancing for another two terms. My father was by now in Zanzibar, and I was asked in to see the housemaster, and I thought I was going to get made a prefect and all the rest of it, you know, for the remainder of my time there. Instead of which, he said to me, "We think it would be better, both for you and for the school, if you left us at the end of term."
Oh.
So, in other words, I was politely booted out, and it was really, really good thing, because in that 10 months between the end of Christmas term and going up to Oxford, I had done all kinds of different things, been to Paris and worked in a factory and taught French at a dying prep school and all those sorts of things in that concentrated amount of time. And I'd written my first play.
Which was?
When Did You Last See My Mother? And I didn't quite know what to do with it, because I had written a novel before at school, which I sent out to all the publishers.
Was it published?
No, it was rejected by all of them, which was, I think, quite right.
But you had the nerve to send your play to Peggy Ramsett, who's about the most famous agent and terrifying agent, had a reputation for being terrifying.
I didn't have that. It wasn't my idea. I put the play on, my play, I was able to put on in Oxford. And the guy from The Guardian came to see the play, gave it a good review. So I took advice from my tutor, who was always very helpful. And he said, go and ask Elizabeth Sweeting, who runs the Oxford Playhouse, or is the licensee, and ask her advice. And she said, there's only one person. You should, and just send it. And she gave me Peggy's address, and I sent it off to Peggy Ramsey.
And what was Peggy Ramsey like? Because she's got such a fearsome reputation.
She was fearsome.
She was fearsome.
I mean, two weeks later, I had one of those sort of Brideshead Revisited rooms on the quad, on the ground floor, sitting in the window, and I saw one of those bulldogs, you know, with the bowler hat coming across the quad towards me. And he said, you're wanted on the phone. Well, I thought someone had died, because it's not their job. You know, they're not supposed to go and find undergraduates and tell them somebody wants them on the phone. But by sheer force of character, Peggy had compelled this man to go and find me. And she said, come and see me tomorrow.
Gosh.
I said, well, I think there might be a Baudelaire lecture tomorrow. She said, fuck Baudelaire, dear. come tomorrow. So I went to see her, and she was this extraordinary, extraordinary woman. And at that very first meeting, she rang up the Royal Court and said they should read my play and think about it. And they did, and they put it on.
What sort of age was she then when you first went to see her?
She'd have been about 50 then, I think. Yeah, but she seemed ancient to me. She was notoriously Ionesco's girlfriend.
Was she?
Was not shy about admitting it. And, she was a force of nature, really. And what she was very, very good, because she unlike anybody I can think of now, really, she was ferocious about sort of quality control. She wouldn't allow any of her clients to take a job that she didn't think was going to be good for their reputation, I suppose. One of her very first clients had been Robert Bolt.
Gosh.
And I think she was very disappointed that he had gone off to do Dr. Zhivago and all that stuff, when in fact he should have been, according to her, writing more good plays like A Man for All Seasons.
How interesting.
And she felt that he had sold out. She was particularly worried on my behalf about this. She was particularly worried that I was selling out because I was very interested in writing films, which she did.
It was a sellout to her.
She didn't like films. eventually, I took a film agent in Los Angeles, and then she really blew up and wrote to me and said, clearly you're going in another direction. And I wrote as impassioned a letter as I could to her, saying, you don't understand, Peggy, I really like films. I want to write films. I want to write films seriously. I don't want to write, James Bond films or, whatever. I want to write films in the same way that I write plays. Then she took me back again. I remember writing a play for television and sent it into her, and she said, oh, dear, darling, do I have to submit this? And I said, well, it's been commissioned. I think I've been paid for it, haven't I? She said, well, it's dreadful, dear.
What was that play?
It's never been done. It was a play, actually. I'd put quite a lot of work into it. In 1983, when the war broke out in Sri Lanka, I thought there was a sort of interesting... And I'd been commissioned to write a TV play. So I went out to Sri Lanka for, 6 weeks. The war was on. And it was a story about a journalist who writes travel copy for Vogue, who happens to be in Colombo when the war breaks out, and happens to... It was a kind of Graham Greene-inspired story.
So let's get back to the royal court. Did you meet Stephen Frears then or later?
No, I met Steve. Stephen had just left the court. He'd been at the court. He'd been Lindsay Anderson's assistant. So he had worked at the court, but I didn't meet him at that point. I met him when I... See, the 70s, you have to remember, was the golden age of...
Everything.
British television. There were these marvellous writers like Dennis Potter and David Mercer who were just writing for television, and they were really as good as anybody in the theatre. And then, if you were making a name for yourself in the theatre, you would get invited to write for television.
Play for Today and things,
yeah, that was right. So wonderful. So I wrote a television film called Abel's Will. There was a marvellous producer at the BBC called Innes Lloyd who commissioned it. And then he introduced me to Stephen Frears, and then he got out of the way. This was what he conceived a producer's job was, which I completely agree with. I mean, I think nowadays producers interfere far too much. And actually the besetting sin of the whole industry, everything, is the refusal to trust the creative people. In other words, I feel very sorry for younger writers now in the theatre because they get workshopped to death.
Mm.
And often I think the most original parts of one's work are the things that offend people and things that kind of make people uncomfortable because they've not seen this kind of thing before. In other words, originality. That's what gets ironed out all the time.
I couldn't agree more, yeah.
Going back to Stephen Frears, I got on very, very well with him. So when the film of Liaison was due to be made, and they were trying to pair me up with every posh director you can think of, all of whom were interested but then beat a hasty retreat when they heard that Milos Forman was also going to make, was at the same time, yes, going to make a film. And so I'd kept suggesting Stephen, and they kept saying, well, he's never made a film like this before, he's never made a period picture.
But none of his films had ever made anything like that before, and they were all brilliant.
Exactly. And I said, well, I want someone who has never made a period film before, yeah, because I don't really like period films. And eventually, Folk Demure, they took him. I gave Stephen the script on January the 1st, 1988, I think, and we were shooting in May, and we were in the cinemas before Christmas.
No, gosh, yeah, that never happened now.
And also had the virtue of there wasn't time to interfere with the film.
Are you finding now people are trying to interfere with you, or is your reputation such that they just leave you well alone?
No, it hasn't got any better at all. I keep trying to say to people, look, the films of mine that have been really successful, like the like Liaison and The Father, many of them are the most successful ones are the ones where they just shot what I wrote. I mean, I've been very, very lucky. I've just last week finished shooting a film in Hungary from a wonderful Hungarian novel called Embers, which great Hungarian director István Szabó has directed, with Ralph Fiennes and Viggo Mortensen and Charlotte Rampling. But they shot what I wrote, and this is very, very, very unusual. And so that is like the 20th film that I've written, but there are another 40 that have never been made.
No, you've got 40 films in a drawer.
Yeah.
Well, perhaps I think you should open the drawer.
Well, I'm very willing to.
So of the 40 plays in your drawer, which is just the most astonishing fact, which one would you, you know, what story still needs to be told that you haven't managed to get away?
Well, my favourite of them all was I did an adaptation of Edith Wharton's novel, Custom of the Country, and it almost got made about two or three times, but it didn't get made. They were going to make it, Sony, and then they released The Age of Innocence, which, to my mind, is a wonderful film.
Daniel Day-Lewis and Michelle Pfeiffer,
It lost a lot of money.
Did it?
Yeah. So it was very, very expensive, and no one went to see it. This is a good formula for losing money. Then a few years later, Sense and Sensibility was a big hit for them. So they decided, oh, well, maybe. At that stage, I was going to direct it. I cast Uma Thurman in the main role. But the other parts I had, Sean Penn and Philip Seymour Hoffman and... some really, really good people. And then The Portrait of a Lady came out. They cancelled it again. And then 2015, the script arrived to Scorsese. And so I found myself in a meeting with Scorsese and Scarlett Johansson. Tremendously excited, as you can imagine, but it never came to anything. And now somebody else is doing it. That's why Peggy Ramsey wanted to keep you away from films.
Do you like directing?
I did like directing, yes. I put it in the past because no one's asked me for quite a long time. But I had, there was a brief period of time, actually only 4 or 5 years, which I made 3 films.
What were they?
Carrington.
Oh, About Door Carrington, yes, with Emma Thompson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I was very, very pleased with, and won a couple of prizes at Cannes. So I thought, oh, well, maybe I'm a film director. And then I made a film based on The Secret Agent, Conrad, with a wonderful cast. Bob Hoskins plays Mr. Verloc. And we had Christian Bale and Patricia Arquette and Jim Broadbent and Robin Williams and Gerard Depardieu.
Good Lord.
And it was... I remember going to a screening in Los Angeles, and I remember standing at the back with this Peter Chernin, who you know, became eventually Rupert Murdoch's right-hand man, and he was running the studio at that point. And the film ended, and he very sweetly said to me, you know, this film isn't going to make a dime, but I really like it.
And did it not make a...
No, it didn't make a dime. It's very hard to get those things made.
Yeah.
I mean, when I spent a whole year working with David Lean on Nostromo, the script for Nostromo.
And did that get made?
No, he died. He could have made it, but he was, at that stage of his career, a sort of complete perfectionist. And he decided there was more work to be done.
Mm.
And I jumped ship. I'd done a year, and I went on to do Dangerous Liaison. It proves that I learned a lot from him, because Dangerous Liaison was so much better than any script I'd written before.
What were the specific things you learned from him, do you think?
He said that it was an illusion certainly I suffered from at the time, that it was easier to write films than to write plays because of the freedom that you had. And that on the contrary, because of that freedom, there had to be a sort of tremendous internal discipline in a film.
That's so interesting.
And that he, as far as he was concerned, any film was in, you know, 6 or 8 or 10 chapters. And within each chapter, there had to be a sort of rope of steel where you didn't, you told that bit
of
the story.
On the stage, basically, for that chapter.
Yeah. And also he was obsessed in the greatest possible detail with what he thought was the most important thing in a film, which was the last image of one scene and the first image of the next scene, and how they've played against each other and how they've flowed into each other, and whether it should be a cut or a dissolve, you know, I mean, real detail. That's why the whole process was so slow. And quite soon after I'd finished writing it, he got, it was for Warner Brothers, and Warner Brothers said they would put up half the money.
Oh, thunder and hail we have here.
Some Japanese company was going to put up the other half, so that was all fine. And casting was, he was doing screen tests with people, and then I went in one day and he said, oh, I told Warner Brothers to go and fuck themselves. I said, why? He said, well, if they don't have enough faith in the thing to put up all the money, then I don't want to work with them. And so, but, you know, had there it was, he could have made it that next year, instead of which he futzed around with it for another 3 years, got it to pre-production, and then died. I did another version, which was really to be more affordable. It's a kind of cheaper version, for Hugh Hudson. Hugh Hudson and I had a rare old time. We went to Mexico, enjoyed ourselves very much, and you know, started meeting actors and so on. But we, even though we had a version that could have been made for, what was this, was this would have been the late 90s, I suppose. We had a version that would have cost about $30 million, which isn't excessive in those days. I mean, a little bit more than Atonement. But we couldn't get the money.
It's so interesting listening to you, how all these, you know, the number of names that have been in this mix, in this conversation, and incredible ideas and incredible novels and incredible stories that just don't get made. It's absolutely extraordinary.
It's one out of three, which is my score for getting films made, is really very good.
One film I'd love to talk to you about is Imagining Argentina.
Yes.
Because that's so horrific, that film, that scene where they make Emma Thompson listening to her daughter being raped. Did people go and see that?
Not really. It was sort of the end of my career as a director, because it premiered at the Venice Film Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they have two showings always. They have the press showing in the morning and then the public showing in the evening. And I was having a coffee and somebody came in and said, I'm afraid they're booing.
Why?
And the film hadn't even finished. Anyway, this booing happened. Then in the evening, when the public show happened, it was a standing ovation for about 7 or 8 minutes, which moved Emma so much that she started crying, and then she said, come on, I can't stand this, let's go. And so we actually left while they were still, and the good old Daily Mail published a photograph of her crying with the caption, Emma Thompson weeps as her film is booed. And so the film was really, really badly reviewed because of all that. I was very really gratified last year. There's a film school in Paris. I had a request saying that they would like to show Imagine Argentina. Would I go and do a Q&A? So I did, and it was very moving to see it. I hadn't seen it for 20 years. And then the Q&A went on for 2 hours, And
no.
And it was really gratifying.
Gosh.
I thought maybe it wasn't so bad after all.
How long does it take you to write a film? Because you're so prolific. Are you quick?
This is a huge a range, really. I mean, I have written... I can write a script in a week, you know.
No, can you?
If I know what I'm doing. Other times it takes a year. Usually the ones that tend not to get made. I've taken the longest. The film that took me a week to write was a film called Mary Riley, which is a Stephen Frears film with Julia Roberts and Malkovich, which is kind of a horror film, which I like very much. Stephen is very grumpy about it, doesn't like it at all. But I like it. I really like it. And the reason I did it was able to write it so quickly was that the novel was short and clear and good, and I therefore relied on the novel.
Who wrote the novel?
A woman called Valerie Martin, American.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So what are you writing now?
I'm writing a film about Handel.
Are you?
Hmm. For an American company. I'm really, really enjoying that.
Did they ask you to do it, or was it your idea?
No, they approached me last year.
After that, what's the next film you really want to write?
I'm trying to decide between various alternatives at the moment. What I do know is that having, although it might seem that I was very prolific, I was actually rather idle in my youth and used to do one thing at a time and then take a gap and then do another thing. And now I seem to be working all the time, and I kind of feel I've become dependent on working. So I've slowly transformed into a workaholic. And Stephen Frears is the same. He's very uncomfortable when he's not working. The real good fortune of my career is that I've never had to do anything I didn't want to do. And quite early on in my career, I was a bit strapped for money, and I did a translation of a Fado play that I didn't like much for Kenneth Williams and Peggy Mount, and you know, I thought it was bound to make a massive amount of money, because how could it fail? But it did. So I made virtually nothing on that, and it taught me a lesson, which was, don't do it unless you really want to do it.
Can we just talk very quickly about the translated plays that you've done?
Yes.
Particularly with Florian, and also with
Yasmina.
Yeah, Yasmina Reza. I mean, that was huge at the time, wasn't
it? Yes, it was.
Yeah.
That was the first time I'd ever translated a play by somebody who was alive, because I'd only done Ibsen and Chekhov and Horvath and Molière and that kind of person. And suddenly I was confronted with a living playwright. I saw the play in Paris because it was playing on the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées round the corner from the hotel I was staying in, and I was intrigued by the title.
Oh, it was just called Art.
When I came back, I spoke to Peggy's right-hand person, was a marvellous American called Tom Earhart, and I said, Tom, there's this fantastic play. I've just seen it in Paris. Can we inquire about the rights? So a couple of days later, he rang me up and said, I'm sorry, the rights are owned by Sean Connery. I said, don't be ridiculous. but it was true.
So how did you lure them away from Sean Connery?
Oh, no, I didn't. I got him to hire me. And it was just on Broadway last year again.
It's just run and run, hasn't it?
Well, it ran for 8 years in London. I think God of Carnage ran even longer.
And then what about your work with Florian Zeller? You've done lots with him as well.
Well, actually, funnily enough, the first play of his I saw was The Truth, which I saw in Paris in 2012, I think. And I thought, this is a very, very interesting play from a young writer. Very funny. But it was rather a kind of Greeky old-fashioned production. So I came back and talked to various producers and said, there's this very interesting play. But nobody really wanted to do it. And then Simon Friend, who is producing The Truth for us now, got in touch with me and said he's got a new play on called The Father.
Oh.
So I went to see that, and then I met him, and then I said, can I translate it? But And then
you did it with Anthony Hopkins, and...
Yeah, he and I wrote the script together. He'd never directed a film before.
Oh, Florian. Gosh.
So he was, and he had a tiny budget, and he had 25 days to shoot it.
Gosh.
So it's very impressive.
How often have you taken a film and turned it into a play?
Well, Sunset Boulevard, I suppose.
Oh, were you did that with Don Black?
Yeah. Sunset Boulevard, I think, was my idea because I always thought I loved the film and I had a sort of operatic quality to it, which I thought would work very well as in a musical. In fact, I first tried to get it done as an opera. And I went to the... I talked to the E&O about it. And then we thought we'd better get the rights. And I had met Billy Wilder a few years before. So I wrote to him and said that I'd had this idea. And he wrote back and said, you're a writer. How can you suppose that I own any rights at all? and referred me to Paramount, who just turned it down blank. They didn't want an opera made of it. So eventually Andrew came back to me some years later and said he'd like me to write the book. I said, there are a couple of flaws in this suggestion. One is that you've never written a musical with a book before, so I don't have any faith that you're going to allow a book to exist at all. And secondly, I want to write the lyrics. And so he said, oh, I've already asked Don Black to write the lyrics. And I said, well, then I don't think... Anyway, he said, why don't you have lunch with Don Black? So I did, and we got on very, very well. And he said, let's just sit in the room and do the whole thing together.
Oh,
and so...
But you're not collaborative, so how did that...
Then I found that I was. All of a sudden.
Was that the first thing you've really, yeah, really properly collaborated?
Yes.
The one and only thing?
Yeah.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, and the screenplay with the two screenplays with Florian.
So we have Dangerous Liaisons going on now. We've got Atonement opening on the 29th of May. And when is the other one opening?
The Truth starts previewing on the 9th of June.
Gosh.
And then it opens... You know, a couple of weeks later.
Not bad for an 80-year-old, if you don't mind me sharing your age.
No, it's not what I was expecting. In fact, I do remember David Hare and I sitting on the steps in our 20s, sitting on the steps of the Royal Court Theatre, worrying about how to sustain a career, because it had not escaped our notice at that point that a typical career in the theatre seemed to be about 10 years. In those days.
Yeah, but you've never stopped, have you? You've never really... Do you ever have time to go on a holiday?
I used to go on holiday when my children were young. We used to go on holiday every year.
And how many children do you have? Any of
two
them write?
Daughters.
Two daughters.
Yeah.
Do they write?
One of them writes music and performs it. And my older daughter is a naturopath and lives in Glastonbury.
Well, it's been an absolute delight to talk to you.
Thank you. It's nice. I sort of enjoy this is one reason you can probably tell that I'm 80 is I like to reminisce.
Well, that's a good oldie pastime.
Yes.
Well, our listeners are going to love it. Thank you again.
Pleasure.
You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalf, in conversation with the playwright, translator and screenwriter Christopher Hampton. If you've enjoyed listening to our conversation and would like to hear more like this, please go to theoldie.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. My very warm thanks again to you, Christopher Hampton, to Bailey Gifford for sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Goodbye. You've been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1?
I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you $25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.